from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Ray Suarez. In today for Michael Krasny, coming up on Forum, acclaimed author Zadie Smith joins us in the studio. Smith's latest novel, Swing Time, follows the lives of two biracial British girls who dream of becoming dancers, though only one has enough talent to succeed. The two take very different paths into adulthood, one becoming a personal assistant to a pop star, while the other slips back into poverty. We'll talk to Smith about her book, her career, and the relationship between fiction and politics. Forum is next, after this. Welcome to Forum on KQED. I'm Ray Suarez, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Zadie Smith is here in studio this hour. Her latest novel, Swing Time, starts in a not-so-long-ago London and races forward to today. At its heart is an on-again, off-again relationship between mixed-race girls that begins at a time when they might have needed each other because they saw some of themselves in each other, and ends in a teeming, multicultural world city where, instead of being an anomaly, having a lot of different influences pressing in on you seems right in tune with this moment. There's a lot to think about. Race, class, status, ambition, social mobility, movie musicals, dancing, self-improvement, talents innate and talents acquired, celebrity do-gooders, people thrown in each other's paths by circumstance, of intimacy and estrangement, a world of disparate places connected to each other by long jet rides in a way that can be a little disorienting. While stories about long relationships are thousands of years old, the world of Swing Time can only be right up to the minute current. When you do this job that I'm doing right now, talking to authors is commonplace, but increasingly book tours involved disembodied voices a long way off, so it's a particular delight to look across the table at a guest. Zadie Smith, welcome to Forum.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
There's so much in here, and I felt like I knew a lot of these people, certainly from the very beginning and definitely by the end of the book. What was scratching at you to write about these people, to create them for us?
It's always – when I'm starting a book, it's like a long percolation. Like I'm never sure when I begin what swirl of ideas or feelings the book is going to produce. But I think in this case, I've been thinking a little while about – power, just about power between friends, between countries, between employers and employees. And that's the idea I wanted to trace, I think, what it feels like to be powerless in those kind of relations.
As I thought about your heroine, who becomes the personal assistant to an at times monstrous and at times charming international pop star, one of the striking things is that, yes, this is a job, but it's only been a job for a little while. This sort of place that she takes up in the economic environment of today.
Right.
She's everything to this woman, M.A. or Amy. I don't know.
Amy. Yeah.
Amy. Okay. And gives of herself in such a thorough way. I mean, you have to be at this person's total beck and call in a way that allows you almost to not have your own life, if that's what you want.
No, I mean, that's the kind of the extreme version. A lot of people read celebrity magazines and are kind of interested in that relation. What if I was this person who had this crew, these extensions of myself? But it occurred to me that in our normal citizen life, that's happening anyway. Like, we don't live like we did in the 19th century, say, in a big house with maids and servants. But in order to live a contemporary life, I mean, the extreme I see in New York, like Uber Eats, you can make a human being bring you a bagel at 2 o'clock in the afternoon because you press something on your phone. Cleaners come in. People look after your children. Some children in another country make your clothes a lot of the time, whether you know it or not. There's, in fact, this huge system of people dependent on you or dependent on your money or scraps of your money. And that system, which is invisible compared to the way it used to be, interested me too.
She hung in with that job a long, long time. And you even note that earlier people who held the same position were sort of used up and discarded a lot faster. Did it meet her needs at that time because she really didn't know who she was and what she wanted to do?
I'm quite struck when I'm in New York how many young people are interested and attracted by this kind of work, right? The idea of the aura around the person, like being a factotum for such a person is in reality no different from being a factotum for anybody doing the same bad jobs, getting their coffee, doing their dry cleaning. But the idea that the person has a special aura that's transforming the work you're doing for them, I think keeps people in those positions a lot longer than perhaps they should stay a lot of the time.
And yet you don't really get to enjoy the things that they enjoy.
No.
Your own fulfillment comes from watching them enjoy the circumstances that you've created for them.
Right, but the whole system of celebrity works that way, right? When we're reading magazines about them, when we're watching TV shows about them, we're not getting to enjoy any of the things they're enjoying. It's like an extraordinary act of voyeurism. I used to get on the tube in London to go to work and see people, you know, sometimes in very lowly positions reading about X jumping off yacht into blue sea. It's an interesting relation. Like part of it is envy, but part of it is a kind of almost like fictional identification. For that subway ride, you imagine that you're in that life or close to that life or have some involvement with it. That kind of displacement interests me, that people are able to put their own real lives aside and enter into somebody else's fictional life.
For me, one of the most interesting relationships in the entire book is between your heroine and her mother.
Right.
Who is a striver.
Yeah.
Who is a self-creator. Who is a climber.
Right.
And yet is not admired by her daughter at all, or only grudgingly.
No, I think I was watching that Debbie Reynolds documentary last night, the one about her and Carrie, and there's an extraordinary line where Carrie says, very clear-minded, my mother thinks of me as an extension of her. I'm an extension of her, and whatever I do is for her and about her. And she'd accepted that role. And in a way, that's what made their relationship quite beautiful by the end, because one person had submitted to the other. But I'm very curious about mother-daughter relationships, because to me it's a kind of battle. And a lot of the piety that's spoken about motherhood, like, you know, you should do what you want and what feels good. And if it feels good to you, that'll be good for your child, because your child will appreciate that you're enjoying your life. And I would love to believe that. But on the evidence of actual children, that is not what happens at all.
Well, it seemed to drive mom, who ends up with a seat in parliament,
right,
a little crazy that she wasn't admired more by her daughter,
right,
or at least appreciated more by her.
Right. It was something I noticed, I guess, when I was in college. It was the first time I met people whose parents had these kind of significant roles in the world. You know, my parents were pretty focused on us, and the family was the world. They didn't have these significant jobs in the world, you know. Like a lot of immigrant parents, your bet is on your children. Everything is put into them, and you hope that they're going to do something with what you've sacrificed. But when I got to college, I met people in quite different situation whose parents had been significant, you know, writers or political in some way, or activists. And I guess I had always thought, that must be a really wonderful family. You know, you have a kind of voyeuristic idea. What must it be like to have these sophisticated parents? But when I met the kids, I found that there was a deep tension, you know, in the idea that these parents, as impressive as they might be to others, were focused outwards. And kids have a very simple and selfish desire to be focused on at all times.
It's a tough straddle as someone who...
There's no solution.
Who, you know, I grew up in... What I like to tell my children is the struggling class. I don't use working class or lower middle class or anything like that, but the struggling class. And worked hard to give my kids a good life. And I don't want them to write me thank you notes.
Right.
I just want them to go out and have good lives.
Right.
But when I was reading some of the conversations between mother and daughter, I thought, oh, my God,
yeah.
I don't ever want to sound like that.
Right. And that I wrote it kind of as a warning to myself. Like I hear myself saying these things to my children. Also the idea that if you were from the struggling class, you tell your children constantly, oh, you don't know you're born. You don't know. But it's a completely unfair arrangement for the child. Like the way they were born is precisely your responsibility. And they can't be born a generation earlier in a different circumstance. What you gave them is exactly what you gave them. It's the parent who has a conflict with the idea that life is easy for this child. The child can't help the circumstance they're in.
Over the course of the book, Mom goes from doing a correspondence course,
right,
getting, I guess, the equivalent of a GED and then an right. AA and then a BA, right. All while trying to keep a life going right. for this family, really does pull herself up
right.
almost through sheer force of will and becomes in the process someone who you detest and admire at the same time,
right.
Believing the right things and requiring that others believe the right, right things as well, being slightly horrified by her own daughter's choice of work.
Right.
A fascinating person, but also a very modern person.
Right.
A person whose possibility, a Jamaican immigrant descended woman growing up in a tough part of London, being eventually able to get to Parliament is something that just didn't happen in other times
right.
in British history.
It's an amazing achievement, things like that, but it is also, I suppose, sometimes personally deforming. I think what a lot of people find so extraordinary about the Obamas, like watching that speech yesterday, is that you see a similar story, particularly in someone like Michelle, and yet she does not seem personally deformed by it. No, it's a kind of almost a fairy story that you could do that in your life and also come out of it a basically whole person. Because I think a lot of us in our experiences of those kind of struggles have found it's not so easy to come out healthy, happy, to raise a family in what looks like such emotional security. So I think they represent more than just a kind of aspirational thing, like a possibility. Like it doesn't have to be this deforming process.
Yet, interestingly, and you spend a lot of time in this country and watch these kinds of things, people have, over the last 8 years, tried to graft that deforming narrative onto her.
Right.
That she's angry, that she's un-American. They pounced on that
right.
Offhanded quote
yeah.
about this is the first time I'm proud of my country. And I hear it repeated now in 2017 as
right.
often as I did back in 2008 during the heat of the first campaign. We're still not settled about the Obamas, what they mean to us,
no.
who they were.
No, it's the steeliness of her is impressive. But she's aware constantly of the amount of projections that are put onto a woman who looks like she is in the position she's in. What's been impressive about her is how quick moving she is. Like she occasionally stumbles in that way, but she won't allow your projections onto her. And that's an impressive thing too, just to hold people at bay and not to allow them a complete intimate relation with you. I mean, there's another example, someone like Oprah, in which it's completely opposite, right? She struggles up, but then everybody is allowed in. Like she, in exchange, she gives you everything, every last detail, every personal thing. It's almost like a offering in exchange. But Michelle's not like that. So that's a different thing to deal with. She's much more cool, to use a word constantly applied to her.
The yeah. two of the most prominent characters in Swing Time are mixed race girls.
Right.
And, you know, as we saw President Obama say goodbye last night, I was thinking a lot about the difficulty in the United States that we still have with the notion of someone being biracial,
right.
of being able to be completely who they are. There's oddly demands that they choose,
right.
Or oddly demands that they acknowledge everything all the time,
right.
as if they can keep reading you their genetic resume every time they clear
right.
clear their throat to speak. And here in Swing Time, we get a lot of meditations on what it means to be betwixt
right.
and between that way. What the men who are in relationships with these two girls' mothers mean to them.
Right.
One white father, one black father.
Right. Well, I think in literature you have this freedom. It's an ambivalent voice. Like when you read Obama's book, he allowed himself some of that ambivalence because writing doesn't come from a single source. You know, when you speak with your mouth in a direct way to another person. It's a statement. It puts you in one place, particularly when you use political speech. And when Obama became a political man, he had to speak from one space. And he speaks almost always, I suppose, as an African-American man in America. It has to be that way because when you are speaking politically, you need a kind of clarity. But when you're writing, the ambivalence is allowed. And I noticed in that speech last night, he allowed some of the ambivalence to come to the fore again, as if he was moving from the political to the personal again. When he said that amazing thing about asking African-Americans to creatively imagine what it might be like to be an older white man at a loss in a difficult circumstance, losing money, losing status. He asked them to do something fictional, to imagine yourself as a different person in a completely different situation. Usually that effort is asked the other way around, right? We ask white people to imagine the condition of African-Americans more or less successfully. We ask them to do that. He dared to ask it the other way around because his consciousness is double at all times. He is a black man with a white mother. And those two things are not contradictory in his existence, though they are for almost everybody who looks at him or is external to him. Inside his life, those two things are true, white and black simultaneously. But that's a very hard political sentence to say in this country. It doesn't really exist.
Is it different in Britain? I mean, these are two young British girls we're talking about at a time when it was becoming more common, but still was hardly commonplace.
It is different in Britain. In Britain, I can't tell you how many times as a child I was told to not to deny my whiteness. that's a very common sentiment in England. They're concerned that the whiteness is obscured by my actual phenotype, which presents as black. So they want to remind me of my whiteness. And they also want to remind
What is someone who does that doing?
It was so many incidents in my childhood. Like sometimes very close friends would suddenly say something like, they'd meet your father and say, oh, well, that's where you get your brains or something. They wouldn't even suggest to them as a strange thing to say. And also funny in our family, because my mother was by far the more kind of intellectually interested person. But those kind of assumptions, which are continual, are interesting. And I think much more fraught for my brothers to be black men with a white father. It was very complicated in England, I think.
Our number is 866-733-6786. The new book, Swing Time, the author Zadie Smith is here with me in San Francisco. She'll be with me for the rest of the hour. There are all kinds of grace notes. Yes, we've been talking about these big, heavy ideas of race and identity, but black and white movie musicals,
yeah.
Dance class, and the sort of self-improvement that comes with family aspiration and signing a kid up for piano lessons or a dance class or art class, or those kinds of things that middle-class people do in an aspirational kind of way.
Right.
In a way, our heroine learns what's essential about dance, even though she isn't a great dancer, and it sticks with her for the rest of her adulthood.
I think the thing you said about middle-class aspirations is really important. I was very aware once my parents started signing me up to things like shared piano lessons, so to save money you'd do a piano lesson with another kid, that it meant something. It meant that our lives were going to be lived at a different tempo than my parents' lives. Their lives were dedicated to a certain kind of survival and were kind of necessity political. There was no room for the non-essential, I guess that's what I mean. But when someone gives you a piano lesson, you're moving into non-essential territory. Like, no one needs a piano lesson. It's being offered as a kind of, like, the top of that Maslow period. Like, you've got your food, you've got shelter, you've got most things, so you can have this extra little thing, which is called a life, you know, a life of things you choose and enjoy. So I was very aware of that as a kid, that something must have changed in our circumstance, that we were being offered these things that were not absolutely essential.
I don't even know how my family managed it. At one point, my mother said to me, do you think I had art lessons?
Right,
and I was like, you know, I'm 10 or 9 or something. I just thought, like, I didn't ask for art lessons. They were okay, I guess, but I can't paint a lick today.
And then
today.
When you see your children, like, my husband made me laugh telling me that he went to wipe my youngest child's bottom after the bathroom, and he'd bent down and said to my husband, hurry up, I can't do downward dog forever. He's 3 years old. It's like, that is a New York child.
Yeah, you bet. You bet.
That's truly non-essential activity. That's the real tip of the pyramid there.
I don't want to at all neglect or give less than due attention to the world of West Africa. And our pop star's personal assistant ends up helping to start a school, which right. is the sort of dream child of Amy, the pop star. And all the difficulties of those clashing worlds right. come rising up to the fore.
There's something really extraordinary about getting on a plane from London and going to West Africa. I don't know if you've ever done it, but there's no time difference. It's a very surreal experience. It's almost like a science fictional experience. So you pass through a zone with no time difference. You seem to be just traveling in the normal sense. You land and you land in a different universe. That is how it feels. A different planet with different rules, different conditions for every single element of life. How to have children, how to live with them, how to work, how to make money, how much things cost, where food is, where water is. It's really a transformative 4-hour trip. And I've been making that trip a long time, about a decade, to different parts of West Africa. And it was the culmination of that experience, really. How to explain how it's possible to live two separate existences, where even the things you consider absolutely essential about your life turn out to be untrue or non-essential, contingent, in just a simple 4-hour trip.
That's and what it catches our heroine repeatedly sort of on the wrong foot.
Right.
Because Africa, they look at this paler person.
Right.
They know she's not African.
Right.
And even while she's less than or other than back home in Britain, she's the same thing when she lands in the motherland.
Right. There were so many moments of self-alienation. Like I remember one of the first times I was in Liberia, talking about gardens. I came up in conversation that I had a garden in London. And the people I was with are very curious, what did I grow and what did it yield? And so I was forced into explaining, oh, you know, there's no food in that garden. I don't grow any food. And they refused to believe that this was the case. Laughed. There was so much laughter. Well, what are you doing in this garden? I said, I guess the children play in it? What do you mean the children play in it? And the more I tried to explain it, the more absolutely insane it sounded that I had a patch of green outside of a house in which nothing grew and some children ran around in it at various parts of the day.
So, we'll continue our conversation with award-winning author Zadie Smith about her new book, Swing Time. If you have questions for our guest, give us a call, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Michael Krasny. You're listening to KQED Public Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Ray Suarez, in today for Michael Krasny. We're talking with English author Zadie Smith about her new book, Swing Time. If you have questions for Smith, please give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. We'll start today in Oakland, where Francesca's waiting. Hi.
Hi.
Hiya.
Welcome Hi. To the program.
Thank you. It's an honor. Zadie, I bought the book on tape, and I've been enjoying it. There was one scene, and I don't know if this really happened or not, about when the children are playing in the yard, and the boys play this game, and they kind of grab at the girl's genital
right.
area, which basically kind of is a sexual assault now.
Right.
I remember being 10 or 11 years old and having something like that happen
right.
on my schoolyard, and I didn't think it happened anywhere else. And I'm wondering, how did this frame your relationship with the men, or how maybe the boys' relationship with you were framed by this sort of childhood game?
Well, this is exactly it. When I was writing that scene, I was quite frightened to write it. But I knew, just from talking to my girlfriends, to other mothers, that this happens to, I really think it's not a conservative estimate to say, most women. And that our childhoods are filled with these kind of incidents. And then later on, there is always this forgetting, collective forgetting. Also, when you have children, right, you can't imagine that there's any kind of sexual activity or interest in the 6, 7, 8-year-old. And then you remember back to your childhood and think, oh, no, wait, something was happening.
But if I'm remembering the scene correctly, it's also freighted with the idea that as the children get older in these schoolyard games, the boys continue to grab the crotches of the brown girls.
Right.
And the white girls become untouchable in that way.
Well, this is also my experience, that part of that kind of assault or curiosity or whatever you want to call it between children pick up the rules of the culture they're living in. They get to understand what is possible and not possible, who can be used and who can't be used. But I was very moved after I wrote that by getting so many letters from women and just speaking to women at readings, like as if it were a submerged memory that many girls have. And then when I went to West Africa and saw it again, you know, maybe in a more explicit way sometimes, or less hidden, just because of the way people live in compounds in these large scales, whereas in the way we live, it tends to be behind separate houses in behind closed doors. But I wanted to speak of it because I think one of the things that girls do when they grow up is experience it as a kind of shame or as a repressed memory or forgotten, or as something that, as you say, only happened to them. And I think it's important for women to speak openly about a kind of collective experience of being women. That one of the experiences of being women, of becoming a woman, is this constant interference in your development, which happens early on to different degrees. In some cases, as in the book, fairly mild. In many other cases, more extreme. And my own mother was a social worker, so I guess as a child, I heard a lot of these stories and came to see them not as exceptions, but as regular events.
That scene, which I reread because the structure of it was very interesting to me. Did the boys in it understand what they were doing as transgressive, as assault?
That, I think having children has made me wonder, how do these assumptions about power, how are they made? Like, it's not, you are in a nice family, you think, maybe a nice liberal family with proper ideas, and yet your child might already have worked out, for instance, if they live in New York, that there are different classes of people, that a certain race of person is likely to be serving you your coffee and another race, for example, isn't. I think the boys in that playground have already worked out that there is a most powerless person within their community, and that is a little black girl. It's something which comes to you partly by osmosis, partly through the culture, through the television, through the newspapers, through the way you see your parents behaving with people. But it happens very early on. You understand that there is a difference between the power of a small black girl and a white man, or even if you were a small white boy yourself. And I don't think it's criminal in those boys, but it's an expression of the culture that they're in.
Kevin writes, does the book depict any positive relationships between either of the two sisters, or these friends in this case, and a man? My question is based on my observation of these models being virtually absent from mainstream offerings. Seems that there is an unquenchable thirst for stories about women and the absence of supportive men in their lives. Is it me, or is it that the prevailing expectation? Is poverty and melanated skin to be equated with universal emotional dysfunction?
No, not at all. Like the relationships in my books, I think of On Beauty with Kiki and Howard, that's an incredibly passionate marriage between a black woman and a white English, black American woman and a white English man. It's not an easy marriage. Like they have their moments. They argue a lot. I think relations between men and women are complex always. But I'm optimistic about them. But this book is about women's relation with each other, for sure. There are lots of good men in the book. In fact, some of the only heroes are men. There's two heroic men in it, in my opinion. A man who manages the project in West Africa and a nurse in a hospital towards the very end who nurses the narrator's mother. But it is the case in this book. This is about women with each other. That was my
the narrator's father, a white man.
Oh yeah, he's a good guy.
She runs to him for solace right. quite often as her mother becomes more difficult right. to deal with, and as she starts devouring everything around her and her ambition. The father is a sort of peaceful place.
Right.
His apartment, their relationship, less freighted with expectation and demand.
Right. I think I doing a reading yesterday, and a girl gave me this beautiful little kind of comic book, like writing and comics that she'd done. It was called White Dads. She was a black girl with a white Jewish father. I only read a little bit of it last night, but it had such a beautiful emphasis, explaining that in this moment where she's young, and a lot of the conversation in that community is about division, about white men in opposition to what she is. She said, "I can't have that mind state. I am what I am, and the closest person to me is this symbol that you're describing, the white man. He's not a white man to me. He's my father." So she'd managed to, it's not that she was in any way less political, but she was trying to have an organic understanding of her situation, that she is a black woman with a white father, and that is not a situation that can be unpicked in her life. It's an intimate reality, and that it's the same for me. I can't take seriously the idea of white man as some distant political symbol to be attacked or fought. He is also my father, my relation, my cousins, my uncles. So my world is not divided in that way. It doesn't mean it's apolitical. It just means that I can't make a convenient separation. I have to consider people together.
A lot of writers have been mulling just that thing over in recent years right. here in the United States, where they are forced almost to make a declaration. I can't go there with you.
Right.
Because these are people that I know. I know they're not one-dimensional,
right.
evil, and desire the unhappiness of people who look like
right.
me. It's a freighted moment, and
yeah.
one that's necessary, I guess.
I just feel from my own experience that even what people are willing to tick in the ballot box or say to a pollster is not the same as their intimate life. I always believe in the possibility of conversation across supposed political division, and I also believe in a basic equality of desires. I think most people want the same things. They might express them very differently and have a different language for them, but I don't think it's impossible to find moments of understanding and conversation. That was my experience in my own family, you know, of wide racial difference and wide political difference, but there was a possibility of communication between us.
Kurt writes to ask, is Zadie a British citizen? It's subject, Kurt. It's in the AP style book. Is
yeah.
she an American citizen? How is race different in England versus in America?
I have a green card and I have an American son and an English daughter. And I don't at all rule out the possibility of becoming an American citizen. If they'll have me,
I'll write a recommendation.
I have a great love for this country that's grown over 15 years, I guess. I'm not American. I'm sad I haven't been able to vote three times now. But race is very different in England and America. It's hard to explain the differences. There's so many. I think the difference that I find interesting, and perhaps the reason why I'm still here, that for all the pain of the conversation here, and I know it is incredibly painful, at least it's a conversation. And I don't think Americans should minimize or not appreciate how much they discuss it. We discuss it a lot. It's not always a pretty conversation, and it is painful. But in England, it's harder to even speak. And so I've really appreciated being here and being part of that conversation.
866-733-6786. I worked in Britain for a time. I lived in Britain for a time. My son lives and works there now, so I get to visit him. And the thing that's always been fun and interesting for me as a person who works in the news business is the real estate that America takes up inside British people's heads. Their impressions of the place before they get there,
right.
their impressions of the place once they get there. And I've always tried to construct for myself an imaginary America that must live in the head of a British, 18-year-old, 17-year-old.
Right.
it seems to some people like a promised land.
It's kind of historically unprecedented, I think, the amount that America exists as an imaginary republic in American hits. So just thinking of my own family, an example, like when we were small kids, I knew everything about, for example, Saturday Night Live. I knew the entire history of Saturday Night Live. I knew everybody who'd been on it since the mid-70s. It was as if that had been happening in my own backyard. And my brothers, meanwhile, could tell you the difference between, you know, an Oakland accent or a Chicago accent. I knew, because of all the hip-hop, they knew everything about a certain kind of regional black America. They knew every detail. They could replicate the voices. I think that's extraordinarily strange. When you think of an American child being able to even tell the difference between a Liverpudlian and a Scot, you know, it's very unlikely. It's not a concern.
Oh, absolutely.
But for us, it was a lived thing. The movies, the music, the food, the images. So when you come to America for the first time as a Brit, it's like visiting a memory. And that's what they always say, you know, when they're in New York, it's like a movie. It's like, it's already entered into you as this kind of symbolic place. It's not that Brits think it's perfect, but they are extremely enamored by that cultural detail, just the expanse of it. And of course, the access to it because of the language ease. You can enter into another world. And for a lot of Brits, for me at least, it was a kind of a place of escape. Yeah.
Jennifer writes, Ms. Smith, you had me at white teeth. I love your characters, your stories, and your point of view. Your book speaks to me personally. Thank you for your work. Welcome to the Bay Area. I hope you have a wonderful stay.
Thank you. How nice. And there's no question. It's just lovely. Thank you.
A listener asks, Zadie experienced so much success with White Teeth. Did that success change writing for her, either her habits or by making it less enjoyable or authentic?
It wasn't like I'm 41 now, so I can be a bit have a clearer eye on it and be a bit more honest with myself. It definitely wasn't the easiest thing in the world. Like, partly because of my own sense of myself when I was young as somebody, I identified with the idea of being an underground artist. You know, that's what I grew up with. The idea of, I grew up with Nirvana and this idea of, and actually Nirvana were a wonderful warning case, right? They begin in nowhere and become, they end up on MTV. I had a sense that if something was very popular or became very popular, it was almost certainly very bad. That was my consciousness when I was a kid.
That's so, a looming crisis.
Right. So it was. I think it was a little bit of a crisis at 23 for that to happen. You don't write a book about a small, like, urban suburb in London and expect anybody to read it, or not that many people, you know. So for a while, I was in some shock. Lots of parts of it I didn't understand. Like, I didn't think I was a funny writer, and then people kept on saying that it was a funny book. It's all that bloody SNL watching over 2 decades. That didn't help. So it was just recognizing that the things or the abilities I had, if I had them, were not quite the ones I thought I had. So it took a while to get used to that.
We'll go next to Palo Alto. Meg, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having my question. Sadie, I just wanted to ask if you would address this whole notion of cultural competence, the idea that a writer shouldn't write about certain characters that are outside of his or her race or culture.
Right.
If you could just talk about that a little bit, that would be great. I'll listen for your answer.
I've talked about it a lot recently, so I apologize if I'm repeating myself, but I come at it from a different angle, the angle of voyeurism. I am a voyeur, clearly. That's what I do all day and night, is imagine being other people, wanting to be other people, and for a time being other people. But I guess the voyeurism is an unusual direction. Like, I get, in On Beauty, I get to be like a white professor man in his 50s and have a really good time, like walking around in his skin. Or in Autograph Man, a young Jewish, half-Chinese autograph collector had a good time being him too. And sometimes I'm an old lady in West Africa, and sometimes I'm a 14-year-old black kid in Boston. I'm in it for that, for those feels, as the kids say. I'm in it for that. So I'm explicitly a voyeur, and appropriation is one word for it, but that is my pathology. That's the pleasure I get from it. From the other end, from the reader's end, there's a question of rightness. My problem with it is, I guess it's always constructed in one direction. Like, I noticed when I wrote White Teeth, nobody accused me of, or few people accused me of appropriation. And really, it was because they didn't think there was much difference between a Bengali family and me. We're all brown, so brown people write about brown people. Do you see what I mean? The assumption is actually quite offensive, that my natural area is just others, minorities, because I'm one and I guess we're all the same. But that's not true either. To write about a Bengali family, I had no right to do that. It's a complete leap. It's a complete fantasy. What would it be like to be those people? But that's why I do it. That's what I want to know. But the reader is absolutely free in themselves to say, I don't find that portrayal correct, even though philosophically I question what correct could ever be exactly when you're talking about human beings. But the risk and the freedom is always to say, no, that's not for me, or I don't find that convincing. But that's the same risk that fiction takes in every dimension.
That conversation always makes me more than a little comfortable. Because more than a little uncomfortable, because I look at guys like the author of Remains of the Day,
right?
Joseph Conrad,
right?
Nobody said, you know, Joe, you're a Polish sort of minor nobleman. Right. You shouldn't be writing about Nostromo. I mean, what do you know right. about a guy like that? Right. Kazuo Ishiguro.
Yeah,
no
that's
one said,
a
you know,
example.
Sorry, pal, you can't be an English butler. This is fiction, and fiction writers create for us people and realms and
right.
ways of seeing. It's that they create.
It's something I was just reading my friend Dave Eggers' book, and his new one, and in it, the voice, or you could say Dave, is a middle-aged woman, single mother with two kids. I was halfway through it, and I emailed him. I said, Dave, I think there's a woman inside you, you know? This is the most convincing. It was speaking to me. It was my experience when I'm alone with my children, when I'm trying to deal with them. It was rightness to me. I felt its rightness. And it can't ever be proved. I can't say that Dave has got female experience correct. What on earth would that mean? But when I read it, my sensibility rose to his sensibility, and we met and had a moment of agreement. And that's all you can ask for in fiction. The same when I read Madame Bovary. That lady, though she is in fact a French man in a dress, is to me... my part of my womanhood. She speaks to me.
And I think Flaubert probably would have looked at you like you were nuts if you said, you know, Gustave, maybe you shouldn't, you know, put yourself in the mind of a woman for the purposes of writing fiction.
I think the particular pathology of fiction writers involves this. There's a wonderful line of Milan Kundera. He says that all novels are bisexual. And that has been my experience of writers, that's part of what makes them writers, that they have a double consciousness. They exist in two places, in all kinds of ways, not just gender, but sometimes in race and class. And it's exactly the thought, the absolute fictional thought is, what if I wasn't me? That's it. What if I was someone else?
And yet, in the modern world, that fetish of authenticity, that sort of... I guess in Britain they'd call it sussing people out.
Right.
To say, like, can you speak in this voice? Can you write about this
but
experience?
It's a literary effect. Like, the whole point of Swing Time was to sound as real as possible, to sound like that was me. That's my mum, and she became a politician, and I went and did this, and I worked for this superstar for all these years, and I wanted to imagine a life. It's not my life. None of those things happened. But what if they did? And could I make it sound as if it were authentic? That's the risk and the thrill of fiction, to fool. It's a kind of elaborate lie, a lie that feels true.
We'll go next to Oakland. Joe, welcome to the program.
Hello. I'd like to ask your guest, the fiction and the things were presented from England on the TV and a lot of literature, too, I think gives us a very particular impression of English people as being, you know, especially well-educated and intelligent. And I realize that. Drawing too many conclusions from this particular kind of evidence. I was wondering if that happens with the American media that gets sent over to England.
Right. Yeah, because if you only watch the recent productions of English culture, you'd think we were all either, in the royal family and or working in a great house. Yeah, it's not very representative. I think it's changed at different decades. Certainly if you watch TV as much as I did in the 80s, you thought everyone in America was either a cop, a lot of cops, or there was that kind of trend of middle-class drama, people living what seemed to us in England incredibly expensive lives. In fact, looking back on those movies in the 80s, particularly the John Hughes movies, that's what I remember, things like Ferris Bueller or Home Alone, the main feeling of British people was, are they really living in houses that size? Those things look like the White House, those Chicago normal family houses.
Yeah, those are Chicago North Shore houses in Wilmette and Winnetka and places like that.
Yeah, that I remember thinking that what looked like a middle class life in America to a British perspective seemed to be absolutely extraordinary, like a millionaire's life. So I think we got a very distorted view of what middle class American life was like from that kind of media.
Part of the problem is that if you live in America, you get a distorted life.
Right.
Because there are very few regular people and regular families and people with regular jobs in a lot of series television. The houses look pretty good. They work white-collarish sort of jobs, unless the whole point of the show is that they're not living white-collarish kinds of jobs. Economics becomes an odd character in these things.
I also think I thought as a child that all federal judges were African-American, because that's one of the things that American TV has done for a long time, that they give very powerful roles on TV to communities which are partially subjugated in real life.
The badass judge is sort of a,
the badass
a
judge
black
is a,
trope now in American series.
Right, that.
what a – it's a weird – now that you mention it, it's a weird thing. Berkeley's next. Tara, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm just wondering, are we in any danger of descending further and further into codifying deep cliches about exploitative relationships, power relations between men and women, black and white? Because I keep seeing the same thing over and over and over and over. White, all the wall, powerful white man being, you know, aggressing toward black women and also white women. And even, you know, children. And I know that exists and that's a reality, but my son, when he was in kindergarten, was French kissed by an African-American girl and very shocked by it. And then that went on for a very long time, actually. She pursued him doggedly. And so I know that's an anomaly, but what I'm saying is, I grew up in Chicago with really richly cultivated, beautiful black women as friends. And I'm wondering, have we moved the needle at all, or are we going to stay in this entrenched sort of, you know, gully of flagellation?
I don't write from that position. Like in my book, that's not what's going on. There aren't really many white men in the book. The book is about the errors of the narrator and her friend. It's much more my interest, the idea that the kind of errors people make are general. Like my narrator and the star she works for are very similar in the kind of errors they make. It's just that the star has more room for maneuver. There's a moment where the star almost kind of steals a baby from West Africa. But the narrator, who is a brown girl, would steal that baby just as quickly if she could get away with it. I don't think that there are certain sins that are the sole, responsibility of one community. That's not the case at all. We're plural as people. We have every possible kind of behavior within us.
You know, I have a little bit of sympathy for Tara's idea that this becomes almost transparent when it becomes so common that we just assume it to be part of just the way things are. But I lose some of that sympathy when I talk to women and find out how widespread the experience and memory of that kind of casual physical liberties is. The tremendous percentages of women in this country who can tell you a story like that.
Right. That is true, but I also guess that when I was thinking about my characters, that they are not permanently deformed by these things. Like I dislike being cast in any way as a permanent victim of anything. I don't think of myself that way. And the characters in my book are not concerned with being the victims of somebody else. They're concerned with their own behaviors. They're asking themselves, what kind of person am I? What have I done? And the narrator finds herself by the end of the book someone who, if you judge her only by her actions, has not behaved well. It's a self-accounting. It's not about saying this community has oppressed me. It's what have I done? What am I responsible for? And that's what interests me when I write.
One listener wrote to ask, does she have any desire to have any of her books translated into a film or stage play?
One of the books, it just became a TV show in England, NW. And I guess White Teeth was a TV show as well. And this one I'm making into a TV show, a kind of multi-part thing.
Some writers I've talked to have been more than ambivalent about it. They like selling the rights, and that's cool. But when they see the ultimate product, they're often not very happy.
No, I was thrilled. Like I saw NW recently, and when they were making it, I was pregnant, and I didn't help them in any way at all just because I had other things going on. But I really loved it, and what I love most of all is the way that they improved it. Like, they're so smart the way that they can fix plot. There's so many holes in my plots, and these guys had, like, improved it. They'd found ways to fix problems in the novel that I hadn't found. So when that happens, I think you should be grateful.
Zadie Smith, great to have you here on Forum. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Zadie Smith is the author of the new book, Swing Time. She was with us here in San Francisco. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lawberg, Susan Britton, and Christina Russo. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Brandon Yu and Maxine Schofer-Wolf. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our executive producer, Holly Kernan. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Michael Krasny. Come back tomorrow. Let's talk again. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.